Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm okay.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
All right. Before we get started, a reminder that Across the Movie Aisle Live is happening Tuesday, April 9th, 7 p.m. at the Bryant Street Alamo Drafthouse in Washington, D.C. We're going to be showing and talking about Arrival. I am very much looking forward to it. I've heard from a handful of folks who are going to be there, and it'll be nice to say hi to everyone. Come up, say hi. We love chatting. I think we're down to like the last two rows in the front. That's all that's left. So make sure you get. Those are good seats, folks. I'm telling you, those are good seats. And you dominate the vision. It's like IMAX, but not in an IMAX screen. It's great.
The French New Wave critics, they always wanted to sit in the very front row because they wanted to be the first people where the light would hit their eyes. It's like they were seeing the movie before anyone else. You can have that experience at the Alamo Drafthouse in Washington, D.C. on April 9th.
You don't even have to be a weirdo French director. It's great. All right, on to controversies and non-troversies, where we have a very serious problem on our hands, folks. Late Night with the Devil, which is an indie horror flick that was produced 2 years ago, has some fleeting shots of AI-generated artwork, and some of the background images have some AI logos and stuff. You know, people are very, very upset about it. At least a handful of very loud people in the Hot House of Horror Twitter are very upset about it, and they are happy to let you know about it. The argument that they are making goes something like this. Generative AI is not only theft because it is based on plagiarizing big chunks of digital libraries, it is also a job killer because someone could have been paid to make the art that was generated by that AI. In the case of Late Night with the Devil, which is a found footage style movie set largely on the set of a TV show in which the host has to deal with demonic possession, the art in question is the logo for the show. You see it in some interstitials, it's in the background of the sets, etc., etc. There are a couple of interesting wrinkles to this story. The first is that the film was shot 2 years ago, meaning before the strikes, during which AI started to be treated like a life or death situation for the artistic community. It was really more of a toy that people were kind of playing with. And I would bet that more than a few of the folks freaking out about this now were gleefully sharing AI-generated images of classic slasher villains reimagined as, I don't know, Ninja Turtles or some nonsense. The second is that the film hired a number of artists to do things like mock up fake magazine covers, etc. And the third and perhaps most important, look, this is an indie film. It's made on a shoestring, did not actually have a lot of money to burn. Saving a couple $100 here and there on a logo is actually meaningful to this production. Now, I mentioned the budget here because it really does matter. It really does matter. And as anyone who has made an independent movie knows, that couple $100 goes somewhere else directly into the movie. You're not getting rich on these things. Every dollar counts. And, that means that there's less of an excuse for something like, say, True Detective Night Country, which used AI to generate some posters for a character's bedroom, than there is for a movie that cost about as much as any 10 minutes of that show, using it in addition to hiring artists and actual art. But look, I am the AI skeptic on this show. I am very, very skeptical about these things. I think we have to be very careful with how we treat it, how we use it, what we allow, what we don't allow. And if we're going to treat AI like we treat, say, fabrication in journalism, if we want to make it a death penalty style offense, I think there's a conversation we can have. But there has to be some sort of consistency. You got to lay out the rules. That said, maybe, Peter, we should just call off the Butlerian jihad and let the computers take over and make all our movies, right?
Yep, that's what I'm looking forward to. Look, I think that it's coming for us whether we like it or not. If Hollywood bans the use of AI and successfully manages to keep major studios and anyone sort of involved with any of the guilds, the whole sort of professional production apparatus from using AI in any form, first of all, I don't think that that's going to happen. That seems incredibly unrealistic to me. But let's say that you'd somehow or another manage to completely keep all the filmmakers, all the creatives from using it anyway at all. Guess what's going to happen? People sitting in their basements at their computers, at their desks at home are going to start making movies using AI, and they're going to upload it to YouTube, and they're going to be competing with Hollywood anyway because YouTube is already competing with Hollywood, and all of the people outside of the professional apparatus are going to end up using it. And so the folks who are making movies are either going to have to figure out how to use this stuff and make it work for them, or they're just going to make that as an opportunity for their competitors, for the people who are out. It's already going to be an opportunity, to be clear, better for their competitors, but they are going to tie a hand behind their back in doing so if they just say, well, no filmmaker can use this. I think that that is absolutely absurd. AI is just a tool for getting things done. And the thing that you highlighted up front, Sonny, I don't entirely agree with you that it's a matter of budget, that like there's, you can be harsher on a film or a TV show if it has a really big budget. But I do think that it's the right or one of the right frames by which to look at the use of AI. So the budget on Late Night with the Devil is rumored to be about $2 million. That is not a big budget at all. And like you said, this was probably a cost-saving measure for the little tiny bit of art that got used there. But AI, if it works out, if it proves to be useful, is going to be an incredible cost-saving measure. And that is going to have a bunch of really interesting effects on the world of making movies, which is even cheap movies are incredibly expensive, right? Late Night with the Devil is a cheap, cheap movie, and it costs $2 million to make before marketing, as far as we can tell. Again, these are rumored numbers, not official numbers, right? But so it cost a couple million dollars to make. And if you can bring down the cost of filmmaking dramatically and make it possible to do stuff for essentially the price of sitting at your computer and thinking about it for a while and saying and playing with things, right? And it's just and it becomes something more like, I don't know, like writing a novel than putting together a team of artists to make something that costs millions of dollars and takes weeks or months or. If you can bring down the cost, then AI is going to revolutionize filmmaking in ways that might be bad, right? There might be some problems with that. I certainly think that cheap filmmaking will flood the market with stuff that is not very good, not even necessarily because it's made by AI, just because when you can get a lot of stuff easily for cheap, then what you will get first and foremost is a lot of stuff, not very good stuff. But it also means that some people will be able to use it to make things that wouldn't have been able to be made and that they couldn't have made, and in particular is going to empower outsiders who don't have access to big studios or even to small, indie budgets to make their movies. And that's going to be a really interesting time to be a movie fan, a movie watcher, a movie maker, someone who is trying to break in, because I think it's going to create opportunities for people who actually do have good ideas and who don't have access to those, to the community, to the professional world, to the insider networks that it takes and the huge amounts of money that it takes to make a movie. And so I just think this is coming whether people like it or not. And it's absolutely crazy to try and take down films or say, this is something that we think is totally unacceptable for any movie maker to do ever.
Alyssa, one of the things that you have written about a lot is ethical consumption of artistic works, right? So, one of the subplots of the story is that people on the internet, that hoary person, was saying, all right, well, you know what? It's actually okay to pirate this thing. It's okay to steal this thing because it is using art that was stolen from other people to generate it. And that's obviously kind of an extreme version of this. But do you think that in the face of what Peter is talking about here, which is huge amounts of money that can be saved by corporations by rifling through vast catalogs of often illicitly acquired artwork that is scraped from the internet and thrown into the AI slush machine. Is there a role for the consumer, for the average thought leader here to play in terms of trying to steer folks away from spending their hard-earned dollars on this sort of thing or damaging these productions in other ways, financial?
So I always think that piracy is a kind of negative and therefore inferior ethical solution to these kinds of dilemmas, right? Like when I first started writing about sort of thinking about how to do ethical consumption in some ways, I think the first piece I wrote on this subject was about the adaptation of Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, which is a book that was really important to me growing up. I really, really profoundly disagree with some of what Orson Scott Card has written and said about homosexuality and about marriage equality. And my argument at the time, I think this was 2013 maybe, was that it was far more useful to donate the equivalent of a ticket price to a charity that does good things for LGBT people or for the cause of marriage equality than it is to boycott the movie or pirate it, because the number of actual cents that Orson Scott Card was getting out of your ticket money was tiny. And even, you know, with those pennies accumulating in his bank account, the amount that he would be able to do with that money was less than, you know, an organization like Freedom to Marry would be able to do with somebody's contribution.
And I believe very specifically with that one, Card actually had been paid up front and was not getting any additional back end from the ticket sales.
I believe that emerged sort of after I wrote this piece. Yeah. And so, you know, and piracy, by contrast, denies Orson Scott Card some money, but hurts other people who are not complicit in his views, who are involved with the movie, and doesn't make any positive contribution to the cause that you're saying that you care about. And so, you know, in the sort of narrow case of piracy as a response to this stuff, again, I think that's sort of a negative solution that doesn't actually do anything to help artists who feel like their work has been unfairly expropriated by AI. It doesn't do anything to help the news organizations who are trying to cut long-term licensing deals for their articles to be used as training sets for these AIs, et cetera. And so I think it's always more useful to find a sort of positive solution. If you want to see this movie, buy the ticket, because then you don't hurt the actual live human beings who did work on the movie. But put your money where your mouth is and actually do something that will be helpful to ameliorate the transition to AI. And I think this gets to the sort of the larger question about developing an ethical regime for AI use, right? Because it's important to remember, you know, talking about generative AI is a very narrow use case. If you start saying that no production that uses AI in any capacity is legitimate, we're going to get to a place pretty soon where email systems, production, payroll, a lot of this stuff is much more automated than it was before. There is going to be some aspect of AI in a lot of the routine sort of office work that we do. And so setting a bright line there isn't going to be that useful. I think as more of these chatbots and generative systems work out sort of licensing regimes or find ways to compensate people whose data is being scraped or used in some way, there may emerge competitors that feel sort of more ethical to work with than people who are just scraping vast quantities of stuff off the internet and asking forgiveness, not permission. I think, you know, you mentioned budget, Sunny. I think we will see some kind of regime where there are sort of different standards expected for productions at different levels, right? I mean, there are certain productions that got, you know, waivers during the strikes to keep producing because there's some level of understanding that not all movies are exactly the same thing. They're not all sort of quantitatively the same kind of production. You know, I think as we see stronger protections for actors and extras whose licenses are scanned, you know, there will come to be sort of an ethical regime about this that thinks about what someone's contribution is over not just the life of sort of their own work, but, you know, whether they're being reproduced multiple times in a crowd scene or whether their image is being banked in case, you know, they're in a hideous snowplow accident and the Avengers still need Hawkeye. So this stuff will get worked out over time, and some sort of regime, some sort of equilibrium will emerge. But I don't think it's going to emerge by stealing a movie and telling yourself that you've done something, like, you know, you've made some useful strike against the robots.
Yeah, this is as you guys know, as you, my close friends know, piracy is one of my big bugbears, and it drives me crazy. And it is telling on a certain level how many people immediately rush to, well, it's okay to steal this thing and watch it for free now. Because none of these people actually want to make a sacrifice. They don't want to, like, deny themselves even the very basic pleasure of watching a movie out of principle. And they rush right to stealing as the recourse. And that, I think, gives the game away in a certain sense. But it also, Peter, I mean, look, the issue here is not just what you see on the screen. It's what is kind of used to create the things before that, right? I mean, the idea that these AI chatbots, the things that are trained with massive libraries pulled from Google Books or whatever, the images that are trained from scraping information off of, you know, Google search and all that. There is a question about intellectual property rights and how those are kind of all thrown together and put in a food processor and spat out on the other end, right? Or no, is that not something folks should be worried about?
Well, there's a question that's in the courts right now in the form of several lawsuits. Sarah Silverman, the New York Times, although, in fact, a bunch of the charges or sort of points of contention that Silverman had in her case have been thrown out of court, but the main copyright claim is still live, at least as far as I know, as of about a month ago. I think some of that is going to be worked up, but I would just say that, I'm a sort of, well, I'm not a total copyright skeptic by any means. I think the purpose of copyright is not, in fact, to enrich creators. It is to encourage work for the betterment of society. And so we want a regime that encourages the most and the most valuable work rather than one that simply creates a cartel, and guaranteed payments for creators. And the other thing that I would say is that synthesis and paraphrase and reading a bunch of stuff and then writing something based on that, or looking at a bunch of images and then creating your own painting or drawing that is inspired in some sense by all of the things that you have looked at, has never been illegal. And you can argue, well, it's different because of the scale that AI does. And I agree that it is different in some sense. But that sort of work that is synthetic and is sort of just taking inspiration from a bunch of different sources rather than simply and flatly reproducing the original work, which is the thing that, copyright is designed to protect against. These are different things. And so, again, I don't want to say, well, there's just absolutely no concern period at all here. We will see as this sort of thing works itself out in the courts. And it may just be a regime where creators get to have a say about whether, large language models, OpenAI models, get to look at their work or use it in their training. But this sort of thing is going to work itself out. And frankly, I again will just say it's coming whether you like it or not. Maybe there are some steps that can be taken to slow things down. Maybe there are better equilibriums and worse equilibriums. But I think just sort of saying, well, we don't like it, we're not going to support this, we're not going to play along in any way, even if that is your deeply felt attitude, that's not going to work. Because someone somewhere, whether it's in the United States or another country, people are going to use this stuff. They're going to train it on works that are widely available, whether they're available for purchase or for piracy. And the AIs are going to know how to make things in the way that AIs know how to make things. And so if you are worried about this, try to figure out how to make it work for you and try to figure out a system in which there is just compensation and reasonable opt-out. Don't say, well, actually, we're just not going to allow this and we think we can hold that line. You're welcome to try, but you will fail.
I also think there are more and less interesting applications of this stuff. I mean, we've seen sort of, the rise of AI characters in movies, right? Like the entity in Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 3.14159. I would actually have found the depiction of AI in that movie more interesting and unnerving if it was actually drawn from sort of some of what we've seen from large language models, because the sort of offness of stuff that is produced by AI would be much more interesting than the sort of all-powerful, smooth depictions of AI that we're seeing in movies, right? And so if you're going to make auto-generate art for a horror movie that's sort of about things being a little bit off, the offness of AI is an interesting way to express that artistically, right? Using ChatGPT to write the entity's, dialogue might actually produce a really interesting effect. And so, thinking about the uses of AI to produce artistic replication, representations of what it is like to live through interacting with AI at this moment strikes me as something that would be both artistically interesting, but also would reflect the ethical ambivalence of living through this moment.
I think we're going to see some artistically interesting uses of AI come out just over the next several years as more ambitious and more seasoned filmmakers get to play with it. There's a report
Steven
already.
Soderbergh's AI movie, right? That's what we're all waiting for.
This is exactly it. I mean, there's a report that OpenAI, which is the maker of ChatGPT, and Sora, which is their video program that makes videos basically based just on a sentence or some text that you give it. There's a report that they're already having meetings with big Hollywood studios to see how AI can be used, and that some filmmakers are already experimenting with it. And someone like Steven Soderbergh, I mean, he might, I can imagine Steven Soderbergh being very opposed to AI and saying, I'll never use it. That's a possibility. But he is somebody who has used technology to make movies that are really interesting and often really inexpensive, that are experimental in certain ways, right? So he released Bubble, Day and Date, was one of the very first filmmakers to ever do that. He released High Flying Bird, which was initially an iPhone app before it was an HBO series. It's just somebody who has really decided that instead of just saying, I don't do that because that's not how we make movies and it's all analog and that's all we ever do forever. He's said, well, look, there's all these interesting technologies out there and they give me as a filmmaker freedom and creative options. And they let me do this stuff. They let me do this stuff for less money. And that's a big deal in an industry where everything is so incredibly expensive to make.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that an indie film used some AI stuff in some of the backgrounds and a handful of shots? And, should we institute the death penalty for anyone who uses this sort of thing, as Frank Herbert suggested? Peter?
It's not a controversy that the filmmakers used AI. It is a little bit of a controversy that the freakout has been, I think, fairly intense, if not to the point where it's, sort of on the front page of the trades yet, but it is now like in the top couple of sentences in the Wikipedia entry about this. This is something that has definitely made the rounds, and I think that's kind of nuts.
Alyssa?
It's a little controversial, but sometimes controversy is how you work stuff out. It's actually, controversy is useful. It's not all bad.
It's controversy, and we should really, I just think we should move real slow on this sort of thing, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do the Butlerian Jihad. I'm just saying it's the thing we should consider. It's on the table. It's a card that can be played, put it that way. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode this week on Patrick Swayze, the dance-fighting philosopher poet king of the 1980s. And now on to the main event. Roadhouse, speaking of Patrick Swayze, now available at Amazon Prime, the 2024 remake of the 1989 Swayze-starring classic about bouncer-slash-bar manager Dalton. Just one name in the original. He's got a second name in this one. It's Jake Gyllenhaal playing Elwood Dalton. He's bringing order to a chaotic dive. He's a former MMA fighter who left the fighting life behind after an in-ring tragedy of his own making. Frankie, who's played by Jessica Williams, wants him to come help her bar, which is being plagued by local ruffians who want to get it under their control. The local ruffians, they're in the employ of this fail son. He's a fail son. Can we call him a fail son? His dad's in prison. The dad wants the bar so he can tear it down and open his own joint and, put some stuff on the beach there. But the fail son, he's not getting the job done. So the dad calls in Knox, played by actual MMA star Conor McGregor, who he has to take out Dalton, Frankie, and the rest of the Roadhouse staff. Hijinks ensue. Mayhem occurs. Bar fighters. Brawls. Et cetera, et cetera. Dalton moves on to the next dive bar at the end that needs his help like a Ronin in search of purpose. The movie itself is fine. It's a competent piece of storytelling. I've always liked Jake Gyllenhaal, and there's something weird but charming about the idea of putting the nerdy guy from Donnie Darko in a steroid vat and seeing what comes out. The action is kinetic, though slightly oddly shot. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. But none of it is really, it's not a very interesting movie except for two things. The first is Conor McGregor's performance as Knox, which I can only describe as demented leprechaun. He saunters onto the screen fully nude, though shot tastefully from behind. We only see his rear. I don't know, like 40 or 45 minutes into the movie. And then from there, just causes chaos everywhere he goes. His line readings are like a variety of shouted gibberish with this Irish brogue. And his face is constantly in this like frozen, mechanical, maniacal grin that makes it feel like he's in a slightly different picture than everybody else altogether. He's insane is what I'm saying, and he's totally wrong on any rational level of judging a movie, but he's also like weirdly magnetic and compulsively watchable. I don't understand precisely what he's going for with this performance, but he's doing it in such a way that I couldn't take my eyes off the screen, and that counts for something. That counts for something in the world of movies. The second interesting thing here, and this is what I'd like to focus on at least at the first part of our discussion here, are the ways in which this movie differs so strongly from the original. And I don't just mean in terms of plot. I don't even mean in terms of characterization, precisely, though I do think something is lost by making Dalton a disgraced MMA fighter instead of a wandering philosopher, lover, poet, etc. I mostly mean in terms of the vibes, man. And I'll just set the stage here by saying that I'd only ever seen this movie. I'd only ever seen the original Roadhouse on basic cable meaning that I had always seen a censored version. So when I watched the 1989 original this weekend, when I pulled it up on HBO Max and threw it on, I will say I was genuinely shocked by the amount of casual nudity in this thing. Like, there are whole sequences that exist solely to get women topless. It's like one of those movies that's like the guys are on spring break and they're going to Colorado mountains and they're ski bunnies, and it's just like a series of like ski slopes where women are naked for some reason. That's what this movie reminded me of for large stretches of time. Like, there's just a dirtbag vibe to it that's expressed most succinctly. This is a thing that happens in the original. There's a conversation between Swayze's Dalton and Sam Elliott's Wade Garrett, right? They're a mentor and mentee. They're having a heart-to-heart about, you know, how to get by in life, you know, what the purpose they should be pursuing, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this is happening while Wade is keeping half an eye on the topless G-string competition happening behind him to make sure nobody gets handsy. Now, look, I am not complaining. There are people who do not like this sort of thing, and I am not one of them. Give me the casual, trashy nudity from the good old days. I love it. But one imagines that this is precisely the sort of thing that gender theorists were complaining about, right? You know, the male gaze and all that. But the raunchiness, and here's my point, the raunchiness of the proceedings in the original give the eventual coupling between Swayze's Dalton and Kelly Lynch's Doc real heat, real passion. You compare that to the rote by the numbers nature of Gyllenhaal's Dalton and Daniela Melchior's Ellie, which is just like the most paint by numbers boring love story I've ever seen in a movie of this story. It doesn't matter. Their dating does nothing. It does nothing but move the story forward at convenient moments. It is, I think I described it to you guys as a sprocket in the clockwork of the plot, right? That's all it is. That's it. There's nothing else there. As a result, the picture as a whole is lesser. It's just a less engaging thing. I guess what I'm asking, Alyssa, is whether or not it's time to bring the male gaze back. Is this how we save cinema from a passionless future? We gotta get the guys leering back again, right? Isn't that what we need?
I mean, something for the ladies too, please. I'm not quite sure that Conor McGregor's like bare ass counts as like for the ladies. I'm not sure who that's for. I mean, it's amusing, but
for Conor McGregor, I think he really wanted that in there.
Yeah, especially since, spoiler alert, we see him naked again later in the movie. Well, I guess not technically naked. Bare-assed, but not technically naked.
We see him bare-assed both times. He comes into and out of the movie bare-assed, just like a babe coming into the world and an old man going out of it.
Sure. So I need to confess that I not only had not seen Roadhouse on like basic cable, I hadn't seen it at all until this weekend. The only version of Roadhouse I had ever seen was there's an episode in Parks and Recreation where a group of characters are like supposed to be, they're supposed to be watching TV at a party, but the cable is out. And so Chris Pratt's character, Andy Dwyer, acts out Roadhouse in fairly extended detail. It's extremely funny. I sent it to you guys over the weekend. Maybe we can put the link in the show notes. But so I had not seen Roadhouse at all. And the original is so funny just because it's so weird, right? I mean, the idea, like, Patrick Swayze is amazing in that he can totally sell the idea that, like, that Dalton is a guy who got a philosophy PhD from NYU. And it's like, it's weirdly specific about the fact that it's NYU that's like in the script. And it's like floating around the country, bringing peace to bars. He's like, you know, it's just like his job is to like be the Zen master of like dirtbag clubs. And that's not an idea that makes any sense, right? I mean, it's like, it's a really silly movie in a lot of ways, right? It's like, it's a movie where one of the bad guys is beaten up by like a taxidermied polar bear falls on him. And he like feels the need to remark out loud, like a polar bear fell on me. And it's like, it's so strange.
If a polar bear fell on you, what would you say?
Probably like something that I can't say on this podcast without us. I don't think I would be like super coherent. I also, if I was dumb enough to like be in a situation where a taxidermied polar bear fell on me, I feel like I would be sort of embarrassed about the whole thing. But I digress. The thing about the remake of Roadhouse is that it feels so generic, right? Like, in stripping away all of those details and giving Dalton like a sort of tragic backstory that explains why he's like really, really good at like beating people up, it loses almost all of the original's charm, right? Like, being like, I'm just like, I'm too into MMA fighting. And so it's like, I don't put myself in situations where I can like actually really get attached to people anymore. You know, it's just like it's so bland. It's so bland. And I actually think Jake Gyllenhaal is at times better than this movie deserves, right? I mean, there's a moment where his character and Conor McGregor's character are fighting on a boat, and Conor McGregor's character is like, oh, we're in our own little octagon. And Jake Gyllenhaal's just like, who taught you about shapes, right? Like,
it's not even about, it's just,
who
he just gets
shapes?
This great, like, weird quizzical look on his face in the midst of the most ridiculous brawl. She said, who taught you shapes? Right. And it's one of the best moments in the movie that, anyway, sorry, go ahead. But like, I actually wanted to single that moment out as well.
Yeah, because it's like one of the only things that makes, and like his character is sort of funny and wry in a way that Gyllenhaal's just quite good at, right? There's that little bit of like, you know, Donnie Darko, the sort of vibe of someone who was like, probably was bullied once upon a time and like learned to be quick with his words about it. And those are the only parts of the movie that are at all sort of charming or interesting. Like, the movie is, you know, to take Sunny's point up, and I think we'll come back to this in the bonus episode, like, kind of anti-sexual in the sense that, like, Dalton has this sort of light romance with, you know, the, like, the doctor character. Again, the doctor character. But he's like, oh, I didn't know this was a date, right? Like, Patrick Swayze's like, oh, yeah, like, I'm going to give it to you good. And Jake Gyllenhaal's like, I don't know, man. Like, maybe I should go home. And it's a weird vibe, especially because the two actors actually, like, that's one of the better on-screen kisses I've seen this year. There's, like, some reasonable chemistry there. But the movie just is so uncomfortable with the idea that, like, there would be anything sexual happening at all that it's just odd.
Look, again, I don't want to harp on the nudity angle here, but I do think it's interesting that like compared to the first, where it's just like every sequence there's like a 40% chance that you're going to have a naked lady on a table somewhere. Like this movie, very specifically, you see Conor McGregor's rear end twice, again, like coming into and going out of the movie. And then kind of in the background, you see a woman kind of naked on the balcony who Conor McGregor is fleeing from, I think, in that opening moment. And like, it's worth pointing out because that is the villain of the movie. He's like the psychotic villain of the movie. The only moment of like actual weird charged sexuality in the movie comes from the villain. And that's, I think it's telling of where the head of everybody involved in this production was. Yeah. And not in a good way. Peter, what did you make of Roadhouse?
It's okay. It is, as Alyssa says, a movie in which everyone is hot and no one is horny. I didn't make up that phrase. I think it comes from a writer at New York Magazine, but it's really a prime example of the ways in which this type of movie has been stripped of a kind of erotic charge that you used to see pretty commonly in the 1980s, sometimes some of which was gratuitous and exploitative and kind of too much. But also, I think we've swung a little bit too far in the other direction, where you have somebody like Jake Gyllenhaal, who has a really interesting and kind of weird charm to him and has gotten his body in ridiculous shape. By the way, I just want to say, as a 42-year-old man looking at Jake Gyllenhaal, that's how we all look. That's the normal way for a 42-year-old man to look. So just anybody who's like unclear, that's 42-year-old man. Like that's the median 42-year-old man right there.
And if you need proof, come to the Across the Movie Aisle live taping on April 9th.
Maybe don't. Don't take me up on that one. He's so good and has such a great off-kilter charm in this. I actually really liked him. I frankly liked him more than McGregor, who I found to be a little bit interesting and I think probably has a future doing this stuff. But kind of one note in his aggressive, obnoxious weirdness. It wasn't bad exactly, but it was like, oh, well, here's the crazy villain. He's just going to be the crazy villain for the movie and he's going to, you know, punch some people and break some stuff and that's going to be that. And it just, it's not a terrible movie, but it's not a movie I can imagine watching again. And that really sets it apart from the original Roadhouse, which has this incredibly, this like mystical alchemical charm to it, where it's not exactly a good movie, but it might be the very best so bad it's good movie. Every single scene draws you in immediately, and it's so incredibly rewatchable. There's a kind of comfort food aspect to it. And that's why it is actually one of the most played and most repeatedly played movies ever on cable television. And that's where a lot of this, the movie was panned when it came out. It was not a big hit with critics, although did pretty well at the box office. But the original became a cult hit, not so much because people went and saw it once at the movie theater, but because people watched it over and over again on cable. It was on TNT, it was on TBS, it was on some USA, probably on some of these other kind of like generic 1990s networks that played movies like this. And they played this and sometimes The Shawshank Redemption. And sometimes it sort of felt like Roadhouse was always on, especially late at night. And so if you were just, you know, if you were a little bit of an insomniac and you didn't have something that you were definitely planning to watch, you would turn on the television, channel surf for a bit, and you'd land on Roadhouse, wherever it was in the middle of the movie, and you'd just kind of watch it because every scene works more or less on its own terms. You've got Patrick Swayze with this spiritual vibe thing that he's got going on that's kind of sexy and kind of weird, and you know, but also has like a kind of strength to it. Sam Elliott shows up, and there's a sequence in the middle of the movie where I think it's hard to tell, but they appear to just like drink and dance and fight and talk shit for maybe 3 days straight without sleeping. It's totally incredible. Just one of the best bits of like sort of mid-movie, there's not even a whole lot of plot that happens during that sequence. It's just Sam Elliott, and Patrick Swayze vibing together for 15 minutes in the middle of the movie, and you're just like, yeah, I want to hang out with these guys. And you wanted to hang out with them. And I don't want to go back and watch this movie again. I don't want to hang out with this movie at all. I just found it kind of very fine. And we can talk about the action sequences as well. And I also found the action sequences really, really disappointing and frustrating.
Can I go back to your point about Sam Elliott? Because I think
so good.
The disappearance of a Sam Elliott-like character in the remake of Roadhouse gets at a bigger problem with it, which is in the original Roadhouse, Dalton is like, he kind of moves from place to place, but he's clearly connected to something and to people, right? I mean, he knows the blind guitarist at the Roadhouse that like he ends up going to work at. He has Sam Elliott's character to like sort of call back on. And like there's sort of a like there's a fraternity of people who understand these kind of institutions.
But you could also view it as a kind of a lore, almost like John Wick. Now, it's not nearly as developed, but it is a kind of there is some world building and a weird lore of like the bouncer verse, right, that this movie exists in.
But also the original Roadhouse is a story about like him settling down, right? It's like it is the Roadhouse remake has all these explicit jokes about how they're in a Western. But, you know, the original Roadhouse is literally like he comes into this Mississippi town. He comes to understand the dynamics of it in a really fundamental way. And by being willing to stand up for himself and the place that he's been hired to work for, kind of reinvigorates the civic fabric of the community. And then he stays, right? Like he has found the place where he's going to stay. The last scene is him and Kelly Lynch like skinny dipping and making out. Like he's found a home, right? And in the remake, not only do you not have that sort of bouncer verse, but the sort of civic fabric stuff doesn't quite work either, in part because like the doctor's dad has been turned into a heavy as opposed to one of the small businessmen whose sort of civic pride needs to be like rewarded and reinvigorated, right? Like not only does Dalton leave, but he doesn't create the sort of social infrastructure that Swayze's character does in the original movie. And so it's much more explicit about the Westerniness without the true sort of Western's understanding of community and the question of whether or not you're going to build a community that can survive.
Yeah, the original had this Eastwoodian sense of, a stranger comes to town and runs the bad guys out and fixes everything up, right? But it was never stated. No one comes and says, man, you're kind of like Clint Eastwood, right? There's not a moment. And this movie, within 10 minutes, there's a little girl who comes out of a bookstore and is like, hey, you're like the hero in a Western who comes to clean up the town. And it's literally just saying that thing where the original left you to discover it and get the vibe and like get that for yourself if you wanted to. Again, just
it's really irksome.
Just not great.
Yeah. Peter, do you want to talk about the fight scenes just real quick, because we're running long here. So, but they I didn't dislike them, but again I just thought they were just kind of competent and uninteresting.
They're not terrible, but Doug Liman, the director, has put together some really good action scenes before, especially in Edge of Tomorrow, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the first Bourne film, and he's a director who I really admire as an action director, and he. Before this movie came out, he basically said, well, look, we've done some of the most innovative stuff that anybody's ever seen with our action scenes, and really kind of hyped that stuff up. And then you watch these action scenes and they just don't look right. They look sort of stitched together and kind of janky wrong. There are all of these super, super intense flash pan cut things, right? That like, clearly this was not a real contiguous shot. And then as I'm reading about the movie afterwards, what it turns out that they did is that they used something called the four pass method, where every action sequence, every hit, every set of moves is filmed four times, and you've got the sort of initial pass where the actors are just kind of faking it, and you've got another pass where somebody's throwing a punch really hard, and then another pass where somebody's getting hit basically with something like a pillow or sort of like a soft thing, right? And then they stitch all of this together, and it allows and then the final pass just has nothing in it. It's a background pass so that they can have the background elements, and they stitch all of this together, and in theory it allows you to show off much harder hits and much more intense reactions to those hard hits. In practice, it just looks like, and I'm the AI guy on the show, it just looks like the action scenes were kind of generated by AI. There is something unnatural and fake looking about them, something distracting about the whip pan style of it all. And what's even more distracting is that whip pan style gets idiosyncratically moved into a bunch of non-action scenes into the movie, where the camera is just sort of roaming around and suddenly was zoop, zoop, right? Like for no reason, except I guess Doug Liman wanted to make it seem like that was a choice throughout the whole movie. I just did not love this, and I especially did not love this, coming after we've seen a number of years of really incredible physical stunt work in action movies, often in fairly low-budget action movies like the first John Wick, or even something like the Beekeeper, where I just have like really enjoyed the quick, punchy, pretty natural stunt work and action that we've seen. And this tried to innovate in a way that I appreciate, because I appreciate people using new technology, but I don't think it actually worked. And I don't think it was all that great a tribute to the original, which ends with just one of the most incredible, iconic and memorable, bizarre fight sequences between Patrick Swayze and the main henchman that like literally just ends with Patrick Swayze ripping the dude's throat out. And that's it. That's what happens. He's like, oh, okay. I guess that's what karate teaches you to do when you know all the really high levels. It's like it's bizarre. And the new movie ends with a bunch of stabbing, but that just sort of feels like, oh, well, there's some stabbing here. It doesn't feel kind of like, what the hell? In the way
and I hate stabbing and find it really upsetting. Like we've talked, like Peter and Sonny will often actually like warn me about that. And it didn't bother me because it was just like, oh, this looks silly, right? It just looks dumb. I mean, to come back to the like the throat pulling out, I thought that we were going to find out that Dalton 2.0 had some like signature move that he'd done that had resulted in someone dying, and he was going to like use it again. It's like, why would you not replicate the like of it all? Was the throat pulling out.
It's, yeah.
Like, you know, it just, you know, like he just like wouldn't stop punching a guy in the octagon. Like, that's what it was.
This movie consistently has a problem the original doesn't have. And that is it's a real problem for a Roadhouse remake. It is afraid to be trashy. It wants to be kind of respectable. And in the end, it ends up being kind of like just OK, but not interesting. The trashiness, the weird sexiness, the oddball, like this doesn't make any sense writing of it. The gratuitous nudity, just like the sort of the the charming level of crappiness to the original was what made it work so well. And this movie isn't crappy, but it's not very charming either.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And the backstory stuff, just to hit on something Alyssa was getting at, I saw somebody joke the other day that, you know, people now think what makes a person interesting is like trauma plus consumption. Like that's the kind of the end result of therapy culture is talking about your traumas and discussing what things you buy. And that is what defines us. And there's a big element of that here, I think, which is the idea that what makes Dalton interesting is not that he is a weirdo philosophy guy from NYU, but that he killed the guy in the ring and is sad about it, and he's got to get over the sadness from killing so he can kill again. Like, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Roadhouse 2024? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
I'm not upset I watched it, I guess. I just don't ever care to watch it again. I don't know. This is thumbs perfectly in the middle.
I'm going to go thumbs down in the sense that if you are given the option between watching the new Roadhouse or the old Roadhouse, there's no reason ever to choose to watch the new Roadhouse. Whatever. All right. That is it for this week's episode. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.